The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
All your other books are nonfiction, so what inspired you to write this YA novel?
My first three books were memoir, you know, and the first was about college admissions, the second was about loving animals and men, and then the third was about running. And so I was working on the obvious next book after that progression, which was about rats, you know, nonfiction book about rats, because I was so sick of myself. I mean, I just could not stand to write in the first person anymore. I didn't want to write, like, do that kind of emotional archaeology to get into it. And so, you know, my agent had sent out a proposal for this book on rats, and I got this email from an editor at FSG, Ferris Rosner Drew, who said, you know, I just read your book on running, and have you ever considered writing a YA novel about a teenage girl who starts running? And I said, thanks, I'm flattered, no, I can't do that, I can't write fiction. And he said, that's ridiculous. And so he basically suggested that I do the book and then held my hand every step of the way, especially through lots of, you know, moments of real panic and doubt that I couldn't do it. So it was his idea to do the book about running. And then, you know, I was interested in, you know, talking about college admissions, because I think for teens that's so big. And then, you know, I also got to include a lot of my rat research, you know, and put it in the kind of from the perspective of my character.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Rachel Tour about her first fiction book, a YA novel titled On the Road to Find Out. Rats, yes, there is a rat in the book. Tell us about Walter.
You know, there are a lot of things about Walter, and there are a lot of people who can't get over having a rat as a pet, especially people who've lived in New York and see rats in the subway.
Oh, right.
Or have had any, you know, kind of urban rat experience. But if you talk to people who've had them and you don't know who it is, who's a rat lover, they all say rats are the best small animals. And if you talk to vets or laboratory assistants, they all say rats are the best. So it's one of those things where you kind of have to get to know one to understand what makes them great pets.
What got you interested in rats?
Well, I had a hamster when I was growing up who was awful and ate her babies. And my brother had a mouse who was wonderful and sweet. And then when I got to college and I felt alienated and lonely, I got a pet mouse, Prudence. And so I had her for my last couple years of college. And then when she died, which, you know, is part of the problem with small animals is they don't live very long. I got a rat, and she was a great pet, especially to have in Manhattan when I was living in an apartment the size of an area rug. And so she was great. And then I had a dog for 18 years. And then when I was living here in Missoula and I was, you know, going to graduate school and I wanted to get another animal, but I wasn't ready for a dog, I thought, you know what? I'm going to get another rat. And so I did. So I had Iris for 4.5 years, and she was a great pet. And part of the reason I wanted to use, you know, to do a book about rats and to use a rat in the book was because it's a really good vehicle for thinking about bigotry and prejudice, because it kind of requires ignorance for those things to thrive. And so if you don't know anything about rats and you just think, oh, the tail is gross, then you don't know that they're smart and they're loving and they're interested and they're playful. And, you know, my rat did tricks. You know, she came when I called her name. So they're really very dog-like for rodents.
Let's just jump right into chapter one and hear what's going on with Alice. She's decided to take up running.
I pumped my arms and covered ground with almost no effort. I was Superman. I was Nike, not the shoe company, but the wing goddess of victory. I could practically hear Bruce singing that tramps like us, baby, well, you know. For 1.5 blocks, that's the part he left out. We may have been born to run, but not very far. After 2 blocks, everything started to hurt. I couldn't get enough air, and each leg weighed about 800 pounds. Great Lake-sized puddles lurked at every corner, and I stepped in all of them. When I tried to leap across, I landed splat in the deepest part. I hadn't expected to see so many people out on this dreary holiday morning. It took only a few minutes for me to realize my New Year's resolution was typical, ordinary, and uninspired, just like me. The boulevard was buzzing with runners, all trekking along in their tight tights and sporty vests, their long-sleeved shirts with the names of marathons or colleges or clothing brands plastered across the front, their baseball hats from professional football teams, and their nondescript black beanies. Some had on backpacks and belts studded with water bottles, as if they were going to be traveling for days. Some people ran alone, and some were in groups. Those in groups chatted as if they were using no more energy than it would take to hoist a latte to their lips. When they came toward me, they'd nod and raise a gloved hand, which reminded me I was not invisible. I hadn't realized when I squeezed into the jeggings my mother had bought me years ago, but I only got to wear to school twice before my best friend Jenny told me they were already tragically unhip, donned a long-sleeved t-shirt from an unfortunate family trip to Disney World, and layered on one of my dad's plain old slightly tatty sweatshirts, the superpower I would most want when I set out for my first run would be invisibility. Each time someone ran past from behind, splattering me with dirty sidewalk water, I straightened up, went a little faster, and tried to hide how hard I was breathing. And each time someone came toward me, I'd look up only for a second, raise a paw in acknowledgement, and think, "Don't look at me. Please don't look at me." My eyes never stopped watering, and I had to constantly wipe my face with my sleeve. I'm sure I looked like I was sobbing throughout the whole thing. It might have been the wind, or maybe I really was crying. My calves cramped up and I felt dizzy. On the other side of the street, I could see a huddle of teens smoking cigarettes or something. They yelled an insult, or maybe it was just a whoop, a holler, and I thought again, make me invisible. My feet were furious. It felt like my arches had flattened into the shoes. Some jerks drove by in a pickup truck adorned with a Confederate flag and honked their horn. It scared me so much I jumped and landed funny, and that made my feet hurt more. I wanted to scream, "Go back to your cave, you howling trolls!" But I didn't say anything. Then came the panting. I was breathing like a prank caller. My arms were so heavy I could hardly swing them. And then a guy with long legs, floppy hair, and a dog that looked like Toto with trashy blonde highlights passed me. "Hear this, people, I got passed by a dog who was off to see the wizard." The little dude trotted fast on his abbreviated limbs. He held his head high as you could hold a head on legs only about 4 inches tall. He wore a harness with a camo design, and his leash had rhinestones on it. His mini legs were going like crazy. The guy took graceful strides and did not seem like someone who would have a little dog dressed in camo at the end of a sparkly leash. Toto dogs go with blue-haired ladies who smell like cashmere bouquet body powder and maybe the faintest hint of pee. People and their animals usually look right together. These two didn't. The guy was around my age. He was attractive. He was so attractive, Jenny, a small girl of big appetites, would have referred to him as a tasty morsel. He glided along, his head straight, his arms tucked in neat by his sides. I struggled to keep up with them and did for about 10 seconds. Then they pulled away. I had been chilly when I left the house, but my body soon equilibrated. Yes, I paid attention in honors chem, and I sweated through my layers. I stopped for a second to wrestle out of the sweatshirt and tie it around my waist and looked up to see another pair of runners coming toward me, a guy and a girl. The girl had her hair pulled into a long ponytail, and as she ran, it swung from side to side, a blonde metronome. She was smiling, and he was smiling too, and he said something, and she laughed, and she turned and socked the guy with a playful punch to the belly, and he bent over, all while they were still running. And when he stood up again, I saw the sweatshirt he wore. It said, Yale. The burn rose from my stomach and settled in my throat. I could feel my face flush. I choked up. The happy couple passed by without a wave, without even noticing me, and I thought, right, in some ways, I am invisible. I am nothing. I slowed to a walk. My nose was full of snot, and I didn't have a tissue. I felt like throwing up. On this day, January 1st, I had kept my New Year's resolution and gone for my first run ever. It was over in 8 minutes. For about 7.5 of those minutes, around 450 seconds, when I had been concentrating on running, on how much my body hurt, on what other people saw when they looked at me, and even on wondering what that hot guy was doing with a Toto dog, I had been able to forget that I, Alice Evelyn Davis, top student in my class at Charleston High School, champion taker of standardized tests, favorite of teachers, and only child of two achievement-focused parents, had been rejected early action from Yale University, the only college I ever wanted to go to.
We're going to come back to Yale in a minute. But first,
Tell us more about Walter and Alice, their relationship. Alice comes back from the run and she's talking to Walter like he's her best friend.
He is her best friend. And that's one of the things I think, especially for kids who are lonely, who are not outgoing, who don't like to do typical high school things, you know, having somebody you can really talk to is so important. And, you know, one of the things about Walter is he's just kind of a good guy. You know, he's calm and he's loving and he's smart and he's curious. And, you know, she even, I think at one point says, you know, she'd like to have a bracelet that says, "What would Walter do?" Because, you know, he's kind of a role model. And for me as a writer, what I thought he did was allow me to show a kind of really human and sweet and soft side of Alice, who, you know, after she's been rejected is, you know, crabby and miserable and self-pitying and just wallowing in her rejectedness. And so at least with Walter, like we see, you know, who she really is when she's not worrying about being rejected.
Right. Because if we had only been seeing her interactions with her friend Jenny and her family, I don't know if we would have liked her very much.
She's awful. I mean, she's awful in the way that teenagers can be awful and wonderful, you know, sometimes in the same, you know, 30 seconds. You know, and I have, you know, lots of friends who are parents of teenagers who complain about how completely hideous they are. And often it's because they're struggling with something. And so with Walter, you know, she just can be her sweet self and not worry about the rejection.
Right. There's also another character in the book named Walter, and Alice calls him Walter the Man.
Yeah, so there's Walter and then Walter the Man. And, you know, she says that she named Walter the Rat after Walter the Man, you know, not in any kind of homage, but to annoy him. And their relationship is kind of, you know, bantering. And he's really, you know, a mentor to her in a lot of ways. And so she doesn't want to give him the credit for being a mentor, but he's a really important, you know, kind of a guide for her about how to think about different things.
He's also just kind of a strange guy hanging out in their house.
He's pathetic. He's sad and pathetic. He's a lawyer. He works with her dad. He watches sports on TV all the time. Yeah. So he's a weird, unexpected, you know, source of guidance and help because he himself is, you know, kind of sad and pathetic, as he even says.
Yeah, he gives the guidance and help while he's yelling at the TV when there's a game on.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. Rachel Tour is here, and we're talking about her YA novel, On the Road to Find Out. If you'd like to hear this program again or subscribe to The Right Question podcast, go to mtpr.org/twq. You can also find links to audio on our Facebook page. When we return, we'll find out why Alice didn't get into Yale, and hear another passage from the book. Stay with us. So back to Yale, which was Alice's first choice for college, and then she didn't get in. I don't think she had ever been rejected by anything or anyone ever before, had she?
No. I mean, and that's the idea that you could actually fail at something, you know, for many people is, you know, a novel and profoundly unsettling experience. And so for her, you know, as somebody who's good at school, you know, and she's doing everything right and she's getting good grades and good scores, and, you know, her teachers think she's, you know, wonderful, it just... She kind of knew that it was going to be hard to get in, but she also didn't believe she'd be rejected. And so dealing with that rejection and then subsequently dealing with, you know, profound loss is, you know, what the book is really about. How do you deal with failure and loss?
But to her credit, she does try to keep her New Year's resolution, and she goes out and little by little runs and gets better at it. In very small steps.
Yeah, and it's hard. I mean, it's, you know, one of the things about, you know, doing something like running is that it's hard. And the hardest part is getting out the door, you know. And so for somebody like Alice, who's super, you know, good at school and a little bit, you know, compulsive, you know, making the resolution, like, I'm going to do it. And then even, you know, when it sucks, you know, going out again the next day, you know, is really something that I think a lot of us struggle with.
But I think she had the follow through. I don't think she wanted to fail at something else.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah.
I think I remember reading in your bio that you were a cross-country coach for high school kids.
Yeah, I was the world's worst cross-country coach. And I got the job when I was working on my second book, and they only hired me because they were desperate. I had an interview at 11, and at 3 the same day, I met with the team. And I knew nothing about how cross-country meets were scored. There are things about the rules that I'm not entirely clear on. But it was this public exam entrance boarding school for math and science in North Carolina. So the kids all lived there. They were just 11th and 12th graders. And I made them do things like vocabulary drills. You know, when we were running, I somehow invented running drills that incorporated vocabulary. I made them write essays. And it was one of the best experiences of my life. And it's why I decided to come to get an MFA here at Montana to be able to teach, because it was so much fun.
I knew there had to be something in your past that would really influence this story, because it's there all the way through. You just know how kids think.
So that was part of it. And then I worked in admissions at Duke. And so a lot of the time I traveled around the country talking to teenagers. And then when I was living in Durham, I became friends with a lot of the college students whom I had admitted. And so I didn't realize that I loved kids until I had that cross-country coaching experience. And it was just so much fun.
We should back up a little bit and talk about your experience with running, because you are a long distance runner and you've been running for a long, long time.
I was never a cross-country runner in high school and really didn't do any kind of sports at all. And so I started running when I was 30. And, you know, kind of like Alice, I was good at it without really having much effort. And, you know, Alice kind of, you know, thinks that it's weird when somebody says you have talent as a runner. And I always found that people would say, like, oh, you're a talented runner. And I'm like, well, what does that even mean? You know, you can be talented at the violin or at oil painting, but talented as a runner didn't make sense to me. And what I realized, I think, is that it means that it came easily, you know, and that with a little bit of effort, I could get better. And I was never that good, but it was something I found that brought me so many different kind of weirdly unexpected things.
Like friendships and opportunities.
Friendships, community, the ways that, you know, doing something really hard can help you. Even things like, you know, when you're suffering kind of emotionally, making that pain physical, you know, by going out for a run and having it really hurt in your body sort of makes your soul feel better in some way. Progress, being able to chart your progress. I liked being able to get better. Being able to just think, you know, to go out and just be able to think or notice things, you know, that are going on in nature, or, you know, as, you know, happens in the book, the kind of intimacy that you get when you're running with one other person.
Speaking of that, that was one of my favorite scenes in the novel, was when Alice and Miles were at the water station and then they had to run back to the starting point. It had to run sweep. And I know I'm asking you to read a lot, but would you mind reading a short passage from there?
Sure. So when they're at the water station, Miles points at a runner and he says, like, you know, that's Bob Hayes. And he says it like, you know, that's Scarlett Johansson or that's God. And actually, even though this is fiction, Bob Hayes is a real runner who lives up in the Flathead, who's 87 now and is still running marathons. And so I actually used his real name. I thought, sweep? Are you kidding me? We have to clean up all that flour he spilled on the ground? Miles had crammed all his stuff into his pack and slung it on his back. Then he raised his chin toward the trail. Wanna? He asked. Wanna what? Run. Go ahead, take the lead. We'll just do the last part of the trail to make sure no one has gotten lost or hurt. He said it would be slow since he'd raced the day before and had done a shakeout run that morning. We've got just 2 miles back to the start, he said, and I thought, right, just 2 miles. I began running and was winded in about 4 steps. I could barely hear Miles behind me. He ran silently and didn't seem to need to breathe. Miles must have heard me panting. People on the other side of the ocean probably heard me panting. So what do you like to read? He asked. Books, I barked out. I could not manage more than 1 syllable at a time. Here, let me go ahead, he said, and he glided past, brushing me in the arm as he went by. Then he slowed way down. He said, do you know why a marathon is 26.2 miles? Even though the pace had slackened and my view had improved, his butt in those tights was super cute, I still couldn't catch my breath. No way could I have a normal conversation while running. Miles seemed to sense this. He just started talking. So the legend goes that the distance is 26 miles to commemorate the run of Pheidippides, a messenger sent from the ancient battlefield of Marathon to the city of Athens to announce that the Athenians had defeated the Persians. He ran the whole 26 miles, burst into the assembly, blurted out, "We won," and dropped dead. The extra 0.2 miles was added in the 1908 Olympics so the race could end in the stadium in front of the royal family. Huh, I managed to snort. Now, that account is pretty bogus. Herodotus, you know, the Greek historian? I made a noise that I hoped came out as uh-huh, but probably sounded more like a grunting pig. Well, Herodotus mentions a messenger named Pheidippides who ran from Athens to Sparta asking for help and then ran back. It was about 150 miles each way. No mention of him dropping dead. That would make him the father of the ultra marathon as well. Do you know about ultras? Pig noise from me again. So an ultra is any race longer than the 26.2 miles of the marathon. Longer? Yeah. Next step up is usually 50K, 31 miles. Then there are 50 milers, 100Ks, and 100 milers. He went on to tell me about all these crazy long races that took place in the woods where people ran through the middle of the night. They had water stations like ours, Miles said, that provided a buffet of snacks. Cookies, chips, M&Ms, Gatorade, boiled potatoes, chicken noodle soup, PB&J sandwiches. Runners stopped, grabbed a handful of calories, and kept running. Miles had volunteered at some of them, and that's where he'd first met 86-year-old Bob Hayes. That guy didn't start running until he was 60, Miles said, and now he's done a bunch of 50 and 100-mile races, and it didn't look like he was ever going to stop. Miles said that you get these giant silver rodeo belt buckles for finishing 100-mile races in under 24 hours. I don't know what seems stranger, running 100 miles in one day, or a skinny runner dude wearing a big metal belt buckle. Miles talked and talked like a teacher lecturing about a subject he really loves. I listened and occasionally made the sound of a barnyard animal. I couldn't believe it when we passed through a clearing and I could see the fire station where the race started. We were back already. Miles had talked the whole way, and I'd been concentrating so hard on what he was saying that I'd forgotten to be freaked out about running with him. While it wasn't easy, it was by far the best 2 miles I had ever run.
Is the feeling of having written fiction now something that feels really good to you?
You know, I mean, it's so weird because, I mean, I really have spent my entire life saying 2 things. One, I have no fictive imagination. You know, I can't make anything up. You know, I can't keep track of things. So, you know, I would get confused if I tried to make something up and it would be a big mess. So I can't lie. But then also, you know, for much of my early life, especially through high school and college, I would do really foolish, you know, sometimes dangerous things and excuse them by saying, oh, I'm just collecting material for my novel. And so I kind of felt like at some point I would write a novel, but I think I'm not ambitious enough as a writer. And so the idea of doing it felt so big and overwhelming and scary that I never really felt like I could. And so it wasn't until this editor, you know, saw in me something that I didn't see in myself, which was the ability to create a world. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that I wanted to get at in the book, is that there are things in Alice that she can't see in herself, that, you know, her love for Walter, her passion for rats, her obsessive researching. You know, often, you know, one of the things that kids are asked to do when they're applying for college is like, okay, what's your passion? College admissions officers say, we don't want students who are well-rounded. We want a class that's well-rounded. And that consists of lots of pointy or, you know, well-lopsided kids. And so, you know, I've had lots of kids say, you know, I don't have a passion. You know, I don't really, there's nothing, you know, there's nothing that I do that makes me different. I'm just typical. And, you know, so here's somebody like Alice, and she gets rejected from Yale because there's nothing that stands out about her. She's just like all the other great kids who are applying. And what she doesn't understand is that her love for Walter, that she then, you know, kind of brings to an nth degree by obsessively researching stuff about rats, that's her passion. And that's the thing that makes her interesting. And that's the thing that will allow her to flourish in college, because there's something that she's really charged up about. And then she gets another passion for running, you know, and that's another thing. But I think it's the idea that, you know, when you're looking at yourself, you don't always see what's most interesting about you. And that was, you know, that's kind of what happened for me with writing this book. Like, I just didn't think I could do it. And, you know, my editor, Wes, was like, yeah, you can. You know, I know you can. And it was really fun. I mean, I've never had fun writing before. And it was all consuming to be in this world. And then, you know, all this really weird things that my novelist friends say to me that I think, like, are you kidding? Like, you know, I just can't wait to see what happens. Like, you know, you're writing it. Like, how can you not know? Or, you know, oh, you know, I feel so sorry for my character. You know, they become real. And I experience it in ways that I always kind of dismissed when I heard writers talk about the process of writing fiction.
So now you like your writer friends more.
Yeah.
What else do you want to say? We're out of time.
You know, I had to really think about, like, what I wanted from this book, you know, because it wasn't something I sought after. And I thought, like, okay, what will success look like for me? And I was really honest with myself about, like, what I thought would count as success. And really what it would look like for me is to get emails from teenage girls who said, you know what, either I started running, or I want to get a pet rat, or this made me feel better about the crazy college admissions process. And I've gotten those emails, and every single time I get one of them, it makes me cry, because I feel like that's really what I wanted to do, was say something that would mean something to, you know, people who I think are really struggling with, you know, with college admissions, with, you know, body image, with getting away from their families, with feeling lonely and, you know, feeling like, well, I want a dog, but I can't have a dog. So I know, I'll get a rat. It's a funny thing to feel so happy about just having produced something, because, you know, I tend to be more achievement oriented, but I kind of really feel like that was the success. Is if there's one girl, you know, and there have been more than one who says this helped me, or mothers or middle-aged women or, you know, 20 somethings, then that's been really, really fulfilling.
Rachel Tour lives in Spokane, Washington. Look for more information about her and her writing at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq, or on our Facebook page. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.